All right, we're in the book of Joshua tonight, and we are going to aim for chapter 12, chapter 13, and chapter 14. Yes, and if that goes well, we will likely next week take chapter 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. I know that sounds unbelievable. And it definitely sounds unattainable for Anchored Fellowship. But we are coming to the end section of the book. And from chapter 12, 13, 14, all the way to chapter 19, really, much of what we have is going to be either repetition or simply the dividing out of parcels for the tribes of Israel. So there really isn't a whole lot of context. Information that we need to go over fresh, except chapter 14. Chapter 14 gives us a bunch of new information. So chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 14 tonight, and we'll slow down in chapter 14 for a really good story. Chapter 12 is a summary review of all of the battles that the second generation was engaged in, all of the victories that they had won. Now, that includes the battles that were fought outside of the Promised Land on the east side of the Jordan, as well as the battles fought within the Promised Land on the west side of the Jordan. Chapter 13 is a record of the land being divided out to the 2.5 tribes of Israel, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh that settled outside of the Promised Land, the east side of the Jordan. And then chapter 14 is going to give us the story of Caleb's inheritance request. So chapter 12, we'll move through that pretty quickly since we've already studied all of the battles of the second generation to the full extent of detail that they were given to us in the scriptures. We've already studied all of that. We've already learned all of the lessons that we were to learn there spiritually from those battles. We'll do the same with chapter 13. We'll move through chapter 13 very quickly because we've already studied the settlements of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And we already talked about what the spiritual application looks like for us. So as we move through most of this, I'll give you maybe some additional refresher information, and I'll quickly just kind of hit some of the high points to the spiritual lessons, to the life application that we have already studied in all of this, just to remind you, just to refresh you. That's always good, right? But then when we get to chapter 14, it'll start with a little bit of ground that we already covered. Same thing. But then we get to Caleb's inheritance request, and that is new information for us. It's new ground to study. Now, we did reference it at least once as we studied through Numbers. We may have even referenced it as far back as Exodus and Numbers, probably not Leviticus, but this will be the first time that we actually study it through, so it's new ground for us. It's going to contain fresh spiritual application for us. It is a chapter that is probably going to leave us all feeling like spiritual weaklings. And that is great. That is awesome. That's good for us. It is a good thing for the Lord to humble us and then inspire us to grow up to be bigger kids in Christ. That's a good thing. That is a good thing completely. And I think chapter 14 is going to help you to accomplish that in your own mind. It's going to show you what you can be. And then when you take a good hard look at what you are, you might be a little bit depressed. But that's not the point of the study. The point of the study is not to get you depressed, but rather inspired. So let's take a look at, as Joshua now begins to reflect back on the victories of this second generation of the nation of Israel, and as the Lord inspires him to write, chapter 12, verse 1. Now, these are the kings of the land whom the people of Israel defeated and took possession of their land beyond the Jordan, so that is outside of the Promised Land, toward the sunrise, which would be the east, from the valley of the Arnon to Mount Hermon, with all the Arabah eastward. Verse 2. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon and ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and from the middle of the valley as far as the river Jabbok, the boundary of the Ammonites, that is half of Gilead, verse 3, and the Arabah to the sea of Chinneroth, or Gennesaret, or Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee, eastward, and in the direction of Beth Jeshimoth, to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, and that would be the Dead Sea, southward to the foot of the slopes of Pisgah, Mount Pisgah. Now, we studied that all in Numbers chapter 21, verses 21 through 30. You can revisit that study anytime that you wish. And if you would like more details about that battle, they can be found in a parallel account, Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 26 through 37. Knock yourself out. Good stuff. Good reading. Verse 4, and Og, king of Bashan, one of the remnant of the Rephaim, and Rephaim means giants, so he's a descendant of the giants, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei, verse 5, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Salika and all Bashan to the boundary of the Geshurites and the Maacathites and over half of Gilead to the boundary of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Now we studied that in Numbers chapter 21, verses 31 through 35. Again, you can revisit that study as well anytime that you wish. And if you would like more details about that battle with King Og, you can find the parallel account in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 through 22. I do want to just point out one of the more remarkable things that you'll read in that section, Deuteronomy chapter 3. One of the more remarkable things that you're going to read there is the size of Og's bed. Now, there's a passage in there that tells us that his bed was made of iron. It had to be to hold this guy up. His bed was made of iron, and the measurements are given to us in cubits, but if you factor that into feet, his bed was 13 and a half feet long and 6 feet wide. He was a giant with a giant bed. So we guess that Og, if that's the size of his bed, he was probably neighboring somewhere around 13 feet tall. And unless the guy really liked to roll around a lot, we figure the width of his bed gives us an idea that this wasn't a minute bowl kind of tall, the guy I referenced last time. He wasn't a skinny 13 feet. But Boss Og was an oinker. He was proportionally as wide as he was tall. We figure 4 feet wide, 5 feet tall. Long story short, not a guy that you want to bump into in a dark alley. Now, recently I had mentioned that Goliath was about 9 feet tall. And I told you that Goliath was actually pretty small compared to the giants that were found in the ancient days, you know, the early times of Israel and the land of Canaan. And this is a good example. We believe Goliath to be approximately 9 feet tall, maybe a smidge over 9.5 feet tall. And we're now checking out Boss Og, who is approximately 13 feet tall. And they weren't contemporaries. But if they were contemporaries, we would have to say that Goliath would really look up to Og. Og made Goliath look small. This guy was a mammoth, just a massive dude. And his death was such a big takedown for the nation of Israel that Israel actually kept Og's bed. It was like a trophy to them. You can read that in the Deuteronomy 3 account. They kept this dude's bed. And, it was like the 30-point buck on the wall of Israel's game room. Like, this was the big kill. Look at that bed. The guy that slept in it took up every bit of it. And more than just the bed, that name, Og, it's like a scriptural trophy. So it won't be the last time you read about Og in the Old Testament. You'll see it scattered throughout the Old Testament. That name drop, that's like the trophy for the nation of Israel. Verse 6, Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the people of Israel defeated them. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave their land for a possession to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And he only did that because the 2.5 tribes did not want their settlements to be inside the land of Canaan. They fell in love with the land bordering the east side of the Jordan River, land outside of the promised land. They fell in love with that. And then according to God's permissive will, he allowed those 2.5 tribes to go ahead and settle there. You know the story, we've covered it. It quite in depth. That was Numbers chapter 32. And we learned the lesson there quite well, that we should always strive for the perfect will of God, because there is such a thing as the permissive will of God, and it's not as good. So we should never take pride in finding out what the Lord will let us get away with. We should always strive to attain everything that the Lord intends for us individually in the exact manner of His choosing. That should be what our hearts are going after. Lord, not what I can talk you into in life with my powerful praying, with my eloquent speech, but Lord, exactly what you have mapped out for me in your perfect will. That's what I want. Help me to get that. Don't let me dictate what you give to me. Don't let me dictate the direction that my Christian life goes. Lord, you have a plan for me. That's what I want. Give me your plan. Keep me on that path. But as these first six verses have stated, the enemies conquered on the east side of the Jordan before entering the promised land. They were conquered under the leadership of Moses. This was before they went in. This was before Moses laundered off into the plains of Moab to die. This was under the leadership of Moses. And then we're going to read beginning at verse 7 about Joshua's story and the number of kings that were killed under the leadership of Joshua. And there's a big difference. Moses has two kings that he conquered, Sihon and Og. And Joshua has 31 kings. That's a big difference. But I just want to take a moment to defend Moses a little bit here. I want to stick up for Moses, because it was not his fault that he did not get to conquer all 33 of these kings 45 years prior to this moment in time. It was not Moses' fault at all. Moses was ready to whoop some Canaanites with that first generation. And whose fault was it that didn't happen? It was the congregation's fault, which, by the way, is always my explanation. Anytime that Anchored Fellowship falls short of something glorious, I say, Lord, you know, it's the congregation's fault. And he always agrees with me. Silence is consent, right? He always agrees. Now, that's a joke. But it truly was. It was the congregation's fault. Now, it's not the congregation's fault that Moses can't conquer all 33 of those kings with the second generation. That one's his fault. It's because Moses misrepresented God. But even that, it had nothing to do with Moses' health. It wasn't his health's fault that he could not go in and conquer that land. It was simply all about his disobedience to God and misrepresenting God. We read the verse previously that at 120 years old, Moses was healthy. He was strong. We know what that means. He was ready to climb more mountains. He was ready to fight 100 more battles. So even that second time with the second generation, he was strong enough to do it, physically capable. But it was that act of disobedience and misrepresenting the Lord that kept him from leading the nation to conquer all 33 of those kings. So big difference. Two kings for Moses, 31 kings under the leadership of Joshua. And to be honest, as far as Israel's history is concerned, in the Bible, Moses' defeat of Sihon and Og is mentioned and championed way more than any of those other 31 kings that Joshua conquered under his leadership. And the reason why is because those kings and their armies, Sihon and Og, they were superpowers. I mean, they knew going into all of those other 31 major battles that if we took down Sihon and Og, the rest is like autopilot. The rest is cruise control. Trust the Lord. If we did it to these two superpowers, well, then we're just going to mop the floor up in the land of Canaan. That really was the mindset that they should have had after those two victories. And I think that relates well to spiritual life because we all fight our own battles and they are specific to us. No one goes through exactly the same battles in life. Some go through a bunch of smaller battles. Some go through a couple really big battles like the 13-foot kind, you know, the giant kind. And we're all different in how we look at those battles. What may be a giant to you might not be to me. I might have kicked that easy. And what I'm struggling with, what's a giant to me might be a piece of cake, a pipsqueak to you in your spiritual walk. So it's never a good idea for us to start comparing one another's battles. The Apostle Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, that those who compare themselves with others are not wise. This is a kind way of saying they're really dumb. You are really dumb to compare yourself to other people, especially in an area like this, spiritual battles. That's something that we really cannot be comparing. We should have no church competitions over who's gone through the toughest stuff. You know, who conquered the biggest giant in this congregation? We shouldn't be doing any of that. The best thing we can be doing is just acknowledging that everyone is fighting their own battles and then be supportive and helpful and encouraging to those as they're going through their battles or as they're recovering from a massive battle. Because the truth is, every battle, big or small, is capable of tanking someone's faith. Faith can die in a big battle. Faith can die in a small battle. And that is a frightful thing to think about. So let's not compare our battles. Let's not downplay the battles of others. But let's just come alongside of one another and love them with the love of Christ. And ask them, hey, how can I help to lift you up during this time? In the name of Jesus, as a brother, as a sister, what can I do to support you in the battles that you're fighting? Regardless of what I might think about them, regardless of how that same kind of battle went for me, what can I do to help support you in that fight that you're engaged in? Verse 7, and these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the people of Israel defeated on the west side of the Jordan. So now this is inside the promised land. From Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon to Mount Halak that rises towards Seir. And Joshua gave their land to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their allotments. Verse 8. In the hill country, it's the mountains. In the lowland, it's the valleys. In the Arabah, that's the south. In the slopes, in the wilderness, and in the Negev, that's the desert. So the Lord is going to give us victory in any terrain, isn't he? Mountains, valleys, plains, lowlands, rainy seasons, dry seasons, rainy downpours, desert times. The Lord is going to give us victory through all sorts of terrain. And the land of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, verse 9. The king of Jericho, 1. The king of Ai, which was beside Bethel, 1. Now, try to figure out what Joshua is doing here. Joshua is counting up the number of kings that this second generation has defeated under his leadership. So he's going to say, you know, this place, 1. What he means is one king from what was our first one? One king from Jericho. We conquered one king from Jericho. We conquered one king from Ai. And so he's going to go on to list out the rest of those kings, 31 in all. Verse 10, the king of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, Eglon, Gezer, Debir, Gader, Horma, Arad, Libna, Adullam, Makeda, Bethel, verse 17, Tapua, Hefer, Aphek, Lasharon, verse 19, the king of Madden. I used to be the king of Madden, by the way, but I just haven't played it in a long time. Some of you don't get that joke. Madden football, it's a gamer joke. All right, well, never mind. But the king of Madden, 1, Hazor. Verse 20, Shimron, Meron, Akshaf, Tanakh, or Ta'anakh actually, Megiddo, and that's an infamous location, isn't it? It's going to be the future location of the Battle of Megiddo, a.k.a. Armageddon. Verse 22, Kadesh, Jokneam, Dur, Goim. Verse 24, the king of Tirzah, in all, 31 kings. Now, we know that these Old Testament books really love to give us the full accounts and then somewhere along the line give us a quick summary of those accounts. Sometimes it'll do it in reverse order. These Old Testament books will give us the summary first, and then they'll go into the full accounts. This one has given us the full accounts first. Now we get the summaries, and we know that's always for a reason. The Lord doesn't write anything in here just to take up space. He's giving us a summary of this because this summary would be very beneficial to those that this book was originally intended for, the nation of Israel. They would get a lot of benefit from reading this. And for us, New Testament readers, it's beneficial for us, I think, in this case, to establish a good paradigm for our lives as well. First of all, the Lord wants us to know that battles fought are never forgotten. The Lord records everything. But what I really like about this section is that you'll notice not one defeat was recorded, only the victories. Look back at verse 9 again real quick just to see that. When the Lord talks about Ai, he doesn't remind the nation of Israel that they got whooped by Ai the first time and it took them 2 tries. He doesn't mention the failure at all, only the victory. And I think that is something that we can definitely learn from as we're evaluating our past battles and trying to use that in a beneficial way in our present Christianity. First of all, I know that some of us are quite all right with looking back to the defeats and thinking of those memories and rehearsing those in the mind because they serve you in a beneficial way in your Christianity. I will admit, I am one of those people. I never try to resist my mind looking back to the battles that I've lost in the past. I don't mind rehearsing those battles at all because they serve for me as lessons learned, learning what not to do. For me, they serve as warnings to direct my present steps. They serve as warnings to keep me at attention in my present spiritual warfare. But there are some that do not like to reflect back on battles that were lost. They choose to forget that aspect of spiritual warfare because the memories are too painful for them and the memories don't help them in their faith at all. So we're all kind of different there, and I don't know where you sit on that spectrum, but I think we can all agree on this. It is always beneficial to look back at our spiritual victories because that's always going to help our present faith. And then to take that a step further, it's going to serve as part of your testimony, and your testimony is important in what you're trying to do, hopefully, which is winning the world to Christ. So it's good for both of those purposes. And what it really does is it It helps you to chart your progress in spiritual warfare. Now, let me just back up a second here. The nation of Israel, they've been doing this for 5 to 7 years. They've been engaged in warfare, battle after battle, 5 to 7 years. And it's at that point that Joshua reflects back over the victories. I think that sets a pretty good timeline for us. I don't think it's a bad idea to do this every so often, every 5 to 7 years. Take a look back, rehearse your victories, get your pen out, sit down and do this, get your pen out or get your notepad up on your computer and type out the victories that the Lord has given you over the past 5 to 7 years. I think that's really important because we all know that growth in our Christianity is very gradual. And you can get stuck in that. And you can fail to identify the actual growth that you're experiencing over the bigger picture. You know, there's a reason why in many homes that have kids, they'll have a doorway, a door jamb, with all these little lines on them and names by the lines, charting the growth of their kids. There's a reason you do that. It's because if you're just looking at your kids, I mean, they go from this to this, taller than you, in no time. And one day, you know, you kind of like catches your attention. You're like, how did you get this big? When did this happen? Now, eventually you're going to see that growth, but it's so much better for your present Christianity if you can chart that progress in your spiritual battles, if you can chart that progress as you go. You can look back over a shorter period of time. 5 to 7 years. What has the Lord helped me to kick? Bondages, addictions, battles with laziness, health issues, you know, whatever the case may be. You can look back at those battles and you can go, wow, wow. I'm so stuck in the present, I forget just how far the Lord has taken me in such a short period of time. Now, as we come to chapter 13, there's something that you should know at the beginning. At this point, Israel has taken down all of the major cities in the land of Canaan. So all of the real challenges in warfare, that is all done. But that does not mean that every city has been conquered. It hasn't. Many of the smaller cities still remain in the land of Canaan, and there are many survivors from the big cities that were conquered that escaped and are now, you know, wandering around, perhaps even returning back to their fortified cities. So there are smaller cities to still conquer, and there are pockets of resistance that still needs to be cleaned up by the nation of Israel. And it's all easy stuff, though. I mean, comparatively speaking, only easy battles remain. It's like someone saying, Arlen, here, I want to give you 1,000 acres. It's yours. But I do have to warn you. There's a gang of teenagers that are using the property to ride dirt bikes on. So you'll need to run them out of there. And for me, that would be like, oh, piece of cake. I got ideas. I'm going to run those little brats out of there like really quickly. No problem. Lord, please sanctify me. Help me. But that's easy stuff, right? I look at that and I say, easy task. No problem. That is sort of a good comparison for what remains in the land of Canaan for the nation of Israel to conquer. So for all intents and purposes, the promised land has been, quote unquote, conquered. Just the cleanup remains. So the inheritances for the individual tribes are now going to be assigned. But I want to just, this is one of the things you need to know before the chapter. Inheritance is different than possession. Those are two different things. We're going to read through this. Joshua is going to say, all right, this tribe, here is the land that you inherit. And the next tribe, and the next tribe, he's going to go through all of them. This goes all the way to chapter 19. And he's going to divvy that all out. And everyone after chapter 19 is going to know exactly what their plots of land are. Whatever is the correct word there. I know you're not supposed to end on a... Well, anyway. Who cares about English style? This is teaching and preaching. And now I forget what I was saying completely. Okay, right. Difference between inheritance and possession. So they're all going to know what their inheritance is. Oh, here we are again. But possession is different. So though they know what that inheritance might be for them, they have still got to go in and possess the land. They've got to take care of any of the smaller battles that are going to exist within the land boundaries that Joshua and the high priest Eleazar assigns to them. So this is where we get all of our symbolism for this book and what it's supposed to teach us as Christians. Inheritance is different than possession. I've shared with you quite a few times now that this book is not a book that gives us a typology of the Christian entering into heaven. I think many of the hymnal writers got that wrong. That's not what this book is trying to teach us. Israel possessing what they have been given, promised by God, their promised land, it should be to us in spiritual metaphor or in typology, it should be that God has also given us promises. We've inherited the promises of this book, and the Christian life is about laying hold of those promises. It's about possessing those promises. So this is chapter 13, you know, all these chapters really, all the way to chapter 19. This is really where you see those pictures the best. Here's your land. Here's your promised land, Israel. Christian, here's your promised land. Here's the promises of the book. And now it's your responsibility to go in, to fight those battles, to win those battles, and to possess the land that God has promised to you, the scriptures, the promises. All right, chapter 13. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years." That is cut and dry, right to the point. And Joshua, I'm sure, said, "Lord, thank you for confirming that. I have suspected that, and now I have divine confirmation that I am indeed as old as I feel. You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to possess." Just think about that. See what that might speak to your heart tonight. After many years of fighting, the major strongholds, they have fallen. Ultimate success is guaranteed, but that does not mean that there isn't still much for the nation of Israel to do. That really speaks to me. I'm telling you, that really speaks to me, because I am just days away from being 48 years old. I know. It is terrible, right? I feel like I'm getting confirmation that I'm old as well. 48 years old. I have been at this for 30 years. And I can say I have come a long ways. I think I can say with a clear conscience that I have conquered my major giants. The major strongholds in my life have been destroyed. But as a matter of fact, I can also say that I am far from done. There are still many fights that I need to fight and win. There is still a lot of ground that I need to take. There are still many promises from the Lord that I do not yet possess. Larry King was once interviewing Billy Graham, and he asked the question to Billy Graham, which is really a dumb thing to ask. I mean, we see a fault with the question right away, but he said to Billy Graham, "It must be rewarding to look back on your life and not have to live with regrets." And Billy Graham said, "I am the greatest failure of all men. I was too much with people and too little with God. I was too busy. So, you know, here's an old guy at the end of his journey and reflecting back on the strongholds that have fallen and the major cities taken in his spiritual battle. And his response was, I'm not all there. I still don't have it all. And I know we've quoted this recently, but it reminds me of what Paul said in Philippians chapter 3, verses 12 through 15. Paul said, not that I have already obtained this or am already perfect, but I press on to obtain it because Christ Jesus has made me his own. Brothers, I do not consider that I have obtained it, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Let those of us who are mature think this way. And if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal that also to you. In other words, if you think that you have obtained everything that you were meant to obtain, then Paul says, the Lord needs to tell you otherwise. The Lord needs to set you straight. You haven't obtained. You haven't achieved. You haven't reached everything that the Lord has set before you to reach. Verse 2. This is the land that yet remains. So here's the small cities that have yet to be conquered and the remaining pockets of resistance. All the regions of the Philistines, and that is going to be an undertaking. All the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites from the Shehor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron. It is counted as Canaanite. There are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza. Yes, the Gaza Strip was a gift from God to Israel, the Jewish people, and they would be justified to completely go in and possess that land anytime they like. It was God's gift to them. It is theirs for the taking. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim. Verse 4, in the south, all the land of the Canaanites, the Me'arah, that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebalites, and all Lebanon, toward the sunrise, from Baal Gad, below Mount Hermon, to Lebo Hamath. Verse 6, all the inhabitants of the hill country, from Lebanon to Mitzrephot Maim, even all the Sidonians. I myself, now this is the Lord speaking, God says, I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel, only allot the land to Israel for an inheritance as I have commanded you. So what a great statement from the Lord. There is an undeniable shift in the method of conquest here. Previously, they all fought together as a unified 12 tribes. Together, they were strong. Together, they were able to mask any individual weaknesses from individual tribes. But they won't be fighting together anymore. Now, they're going to be fighting individually. And tribes are going to have weaknesses. Not all tribes are created equal. You're going to have strong tribes and weak tribes. You're going to have small tribes. You're going to have big tribes. You're going to have some tribes that are good at obeying God, some tribes that are not. You're going to have some tribes that have really big faith and some tribes that have pretty small faith. And what God is promising here, though, is that in spite of this change of methodology for conquest, that it is still going to be God that is driving out the enemy. That God is going to be the same God for them in their individual tribal battles as he was when the tribes were all fighting together as a unified force. He was going to be as faithfully to them individually as he was with them collectively. He is going to be as powerful for them individually as he was when they were fighting collectively. Now, maybe you feel like you're a superhero when you come to church and you're in the sanctuary and Christianity's easy. You got all kind of support around you. And when you're fighting battles where you can get other people's help, their prayer help, their support, and maybe you feel differently when you're fighting those battles alone. Or maybe you just feel different when you leave the sanctuary and you go home and you're alone for the week. And it shouldn't be that way. God will be the same God for you in your home. He will be the same God for you in your individual personal struggles, as he is with you here in the sanctuary, or, you know, when you're fighting battles together with brothers and sisters. So put your faith to that. Never forget that. Just because I'm separated from the pack, that doesn't make me weak. I'm still God's. God is still fighting for me. He's still driving out the enemies in my life. Verse 7. Now therefore, divide this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh. And this can be a little bit confusing here, but verse 7, it sounds like it's a lead-in for the dividing up of the land for the nine and a half tribes, but it's not. The Lord is actually only going to focus here in chapter 13 on those two and a half tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, those that settled outside the land of promise. So, focusing on those two and a half tribes on the east side of the Jordan, verse 8, with the other half of the tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan eastward, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them, Numbers chapter 32. Reading on, verse 9, from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and the city that is on the middle of the valley, that is in the middle of the valley, and the tableland or plains of Medeba, as far as Dibon, verse 10, and all the cities of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, as far as the boundary of the Ammonites, verse 11, and Gilead, and the region of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and all Mount Hermon and all Bashan to Selekah, verse 12, all the kingdoms of Og and Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth and in Edrei, he alone was left of the remnant of the Rephaim, the giants. These Moses has struck and driven out, verse 13, yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. Well, what do you know? The two and a half tribes that could not hold out for the perfect will of God and enter into the promised land. The two and a half tribes that decided that they wanted to stop short of the perfect will of God and settle outside of the promised land have also, in this instance, stopped short of the perfect will of God. They failed to completely drive out the enemies from the land that Moses had divided out to them. What was God's command? Conquer them completely. Drive them out. Purge the land completely before you settle it. And what do these guys do here? They reach a point where they say, good enough. You know, I mean, we killed most of them. We chased off a bunch of them. We're the majority. They're the minority. What harm could they possibly be to us now? And we know that's not the issue, is it? The issue isn't what can the enemy do to you now if he's still got a foot in the door. The issue is always going to be, if you let him keep the foot in the door, what's he going to do to you in the future? These tribes are going to grow. These remnants that they didn't completely wipe out or chase out, they're going to grow. They're going to stay put, and things are going to change. The balance is going to get upset. And one day, they're going to have some major battles on their hands because they didn't listen to the Lord. They let the enemy keep the foot in the door. So it's become sort of a characteristic of these two and a half tribes that they're comfortable getting close to the will of God for their life, but not tenacious enough to go all in on God's plan for them. So don't be like these two and a half tribes. Don't get easily contented in spiritual life. Don't be one of those, well, close enough Christians. Have I possessed all of the promises of Scripture that God has given to me? No, close enough. Do I look like Christ in my life? No, close enough. Don't be one of those close enough Christians. Be all in on God's will for your life. And don't let the enemy keep his foot in the door. Kick it out of there. Close the door. Verse 14. To the tribe of Levi alone, Moses gave no inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord God of Israel are their inheritance, as he said to him. And we'll talk about that very briefly when we get to verse 33. Verse 15. And Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of the people of Reuben according to their clans, verse 16. So their territory was from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and the city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland by Medeba, verse 17, with Heshbon and all its cities that are in the tableland, Dibon and Bamoth, Baal and Beth Baal Meon, he just rolls off the tongue, and Jahaz, and Kedemoth, and Mephaath, verse 19, and Kiriathaim, and Sibma, and Zereth Shahar, on the hill of the valley, verse 20, and Beth Peor, and the slopes of Pisgah, and Beth Jeshimoth, verse 21, that is, all the cities of the tableland, the plains, and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses defeated with the leaders of Midian, Evi, and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, the princes of Sihon, who lived in the land. Verse 22, Balaam also, the son of Beor, the one who practiced divination, was killed with the sword by the people of Israel, among the rest of their slain. And we studied Balaam's story in full. That was Numbers chapter 22 through 25. So we really exhaustively studied the life, the event of Balaam trying to curse the nation of Israel and God not allowing him to. He opened his mouth multiple times and prophesied, and his prophecies were this: Israel's going to succeed. You can't stop them. You can't curse them. And yet, though those were the prophecies that came out of this man's mouth, at the end, what does he do? He picks a side, and it's the wrong one. Even though he knows God has said you cannot defeat the nation of Israel, you cannot curse them, you cannot take them down, here he is in verse 22 fighting against the nation of Israel. And that is where he will have the last chapter of his life written. That would be the death of him. Lesson learned there? Simple. Take your own biblical advice. If you're going to prophesy, follow your own prophecy. If you're going to preach, practice your own preaching. If you're going to teach, then listen to your own teaching and live it out. It is not good enough to know sound Bible doctrine until you're actually living it out in your own life. That's the lesson we've studied in full because of the story of Balaam. Verse 23, and the border of the people of Reuben was the Jordan as a boundary. This was the inheritance of the people of Reuben according to their clans, with their cities and villages. Verse 24, Moses gave an inheritance also to the tribe of Gad, to the people of Gad according to their clans. 25, their territory was Jazer, and all the cities of Gilead, and half the land of the Ammonites, Aroer, which is east of Rabbah. Verse 26, and from Heshbon to Ramath Mizpah, and Betonim, and from Mahanaim to the territory of Debir. Verse 27, and in the valley Beth Haram, Beth Nimrah, Sukkoth, and Zaphon, the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, having the Jordan as a boundary to the lower end of the Sea of Chinnereth, eastward beyond the Jordan. Verse 28, this is the inheritance of the people of Gad. So in case you didn't catch that, we're going down through the 2.5 tribes. He's establishing their territories. The people of Gad, according to their clans, with their villages, with their cities and villages. 29, and Moses gave an inheritance to the half tribe of Manasseh. It was allotted to the half tribe of the people of Manasseh according to their clans. Verse 30, their region extended from Mahanaim through all Bashan, the whole kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and all the towns of Jair, which are in Bashan, 60 cities. Verse 31, and half Gilead, and Ashtaroth, and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. These were allotted to the people of Machir, the son of Manasseh, for half of the people of Machir, according to their clans. Verse 32, these are the inheritances that Moses distributed in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan east of Jericho. Again, we studied that in Numbers 32. Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh, they get their land allotments outside of the land of promise. Feel free to review that study anytime that you would like. Verse 33, but to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. And of course, we covered Levi's story very well, too. Levi was the first tribe to stand up and try to correct the mess that was caused by the worship of the golden calf, the creation and the worship of the golden calf. Prior to that time, God's plan for ministry was that because he had redeemed, purchased back the firstborn of Israel on that final night of leaving Egypt, that God would just use all of the firstborn males as ministry workers in the tabernacle. Now that would be an overabundance of workers. So I don't know how you would divide up that ministry time. You might only get to serve in the tabernacle once every 5 years. But when the tribe of Levi did that, when they stood up and were willing to do the dirty work necessary to clean up that mess that came from Israel's idolatry as Moses was up there on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments, the Lord said, I want that tribe. Change of plans. I want that tribe. I'm now no longer going to take the firstborn of the nation of Israel to serve as ministry workers. I'm just going to take that tribe, the tribe of Levi. And because God took the tribe of Levi as those that would serve in the ministry of the tabernacle, that meant that they would not get land allotments as would the rest of those tribes. The Lord decided he didn't want that. He didn't want his ministry workers, his priests. He did not want them out there working the land, farming the corn, raising and milking the cows. He didn't want them having side jobs. He wanted them to be completely devoted, completely consumed with the ministry work. He wanted their business to be about the tabernacle. And so the Lord said, I don't want you owning land. I don't want you working land. I don't want you having side jobs. I want you to be completely consumed with ministry work. But let's face it, they had to live somewhere. And so the Lord worked that out. The Lord gave an allotment of 48 cities that were scattered throughout the land of Israel. Not just one spot, scattered throughout. Why might the Lord do that? Well, he's doing that to scatter their influence. He wants that influence of consecration and holiness to be scattered all throughout the land. You know, that'd be kind of cool. Like you could just walk down the street and there's a family of priests and you could talk to them about the Lord and the work of the tabernacle. Pretty cool thing. The Lord scattered them out. They did not own those cities. They did not own land. It was kind of like parsonages. Does anyone still know what a parsonage is? It's an old church term. A parsonage is a pastor's home that is paid for and provided by the church that he labors in. These were parsonages. So they didn't own them, but they had them to live in. And their focus was to be on the tabernacle work. And that was not a bummer for them. It was not a bummer that they couldn't own land and farms and you know, have side jobs. It was an incredible privilege. They had the wonderful privilege of getting to minister to the people and getting the even better thing, and getting to minister to the Lord. That's an even better thing. It's wonderful to minister to people. It's better to minister to the Lord. It's wonderful to bless people. It's better to bless the Lord. So we move on now to chapter 14, and I am totally kidding. We're not going to have time to do that tonight. What do you know? I set my sights just a little bit too, what's the word? High. That's a good word. Yeah, I set my sights too high. We'll stick with that. So next week, chapter 14. Maybe we'll just spend the whole week on chapter 14. And then the following week, we'll do chapter 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. Yeah, I don't believe myself anymore. Let's stand.